Welcome to Discover Joyous Love with Anita DeFrancesco as your host. This is a hybrid of topics under the subjects of mindfulness, sexuality, and relationships. Hello, and welcome to another episode here. And today, this is my guest, episode number 46, and Discover Joyous Love. I'm your host, Anita DeFrancesco. And today I have an interesting guest, an interesting topic, Matt Friedman from the Mekong Club in Hong Kong, who has authored a book called Where Were You? A Profile of Modern Slavery. Mm-hmm. And this book, interesting. Hi, Matt. How are you?
Hi, how are you doing? Good to be here.
Let me just give a little bio about you. Matt here is an international human trafficking expert with more than 30 years experience, is the CEO of the Mekong Club, an organization of Hong Kong's leading businesses, which has joined forces to help end all forms of modern slavery. Mr. Friedman previously worked for USAID and the United Nations in over 30 countries. Mr. Friedman offers technical advice in numerous governments, banks, and corporations working to eliminate all forms of modern slavery, and he's the author of 12 books. But the book we're talking about today, again, is Where Are You? A Profile of Modern Slavery. He's also Asia's prestigious Communicator of the Year Gold Award. Hello, Matt. Welcome. Tell me all about you. And
hello.
Yes. How's Hong Kong? You've been there? Are you from Hong Kong or...?
I actually grew up in Connecticut in the United States, went overseas 30 years ago thinking it was going to be for 8 months, and I haven't been able to find my way back since.
30 months or years?
30 years, actually.
Wow. And Hong Kong is a real nice place, I'll bet, to live. I've traveled a lot, but I haven't abroad, but not there.
Yeah, I started in Nepal. I was there for 8 years, 5 years in Bangladesh, 10 years in Thailand, and now I'm in Hong Kong. So went from some of the least developing countries to one of the most developed kind of portions of China.
Yeah, and I've been to Thailand. I seem to like it there. It seems to be a popular place for people nowadays.
It certainly is, yeah. Great place to live.
Yes. So this book you've written here, you've written 12 books. What are your other books about?
A couple of books are novels that I've written. Just to, waste time in airports. Some of them are based on philosophy. A couple of technical books on metal casting in Bangladesh, how the lost wax method is. I used to do a lot of traveling. And, when you go and you're on an airplane and you don't really want to do work, you want to do something else. So I just got into the habit of just writing. And most of these books have been published. And I'm quite happy to have that opportunity in my life.
Wow, novels. What type of novels? Just general novels, reading. What genre?
Thrillers, drama. My latest book, Dancing in the Light of the Moon, is based in India. It's based in India. Some people relate to the topic through kind of a more didactic approach or a nonfiction approach. Others, they like it through storytelling. So what I was able to do is collect all this information and then weave it into a story with a number of characters to look at human trafficking, forced labor, various other things from the perspective of people who have experienced it in India. And the other thing you can do with that is help people to understand that all the criminals aren't horribly terrible and all the good people aren't without their own flaws and foibles.
Interesting. It's an interesting balance, huh? An interesting balance that you bring to light for the reader.
Yeah. And the other thing is I was doing a lot of technical writing and I felt like I needed to go to, I don't know which side of the brain is the more creative side, but when you write fiction, you can pretty much go off and use your imagination and do things that you can't do with a very technical report. And in fact, I think it's improved my writing as a result of it.
Okay. Wonderful. So on the subject of Where Were You? A Profile of Modern Slavery, your latest book, what inspired you firstly to write this book?
Well, there's a lot of books that are out there and many of them are good, but they tend to be focused on sex trafficking or on the fishing industry in Thailand or something else. I was unable to really find a book that was a compendium of all different types of human trafficking, the historical perspective, how it started, where is it, what needs to be done, and so forth. So my motivation for writing this was to have kind of a textbook on what you need to know if you want to know about human trafficking and how it started and everything else. The other thing is just there's just tremendous low awareness of the topic of human trafficking. I recently did a presentation tour across North America, started in Canada, spent 3 weeks there, almost a month in the United States, presented 91 times to 12,000 people. And I'm always astounded by the low level of basic awareness of this topic of human trafficking. People have a general sense that it has something to do with girls and brothels, but they don't really have a framework in their mind to understand when they get stories or information in what it all means. And so I tried to have this book focus on developing this framework for a person. So once you read this, you pretty much understand what you need to know as new information comes in.
So my understanding of your book in the way that the modern slavery is, you know, girls, young girls that are taken and held hostage, correct? That is the real true sex trafficking that you see movies on television, that they're controlled by a group of, you know, some type of group that is selling. In the United States, you know, sex trafficking is the broad term for people that were to do sex work, say that work in brothels or girls that, you know, women, girls who do massages and they add sex into it, and they're doing that in a consensual way. But if they were to get arrested, it's considered sex trafficking, which is a higher charge in the United States than, say, sex work, aka prostitution. So that is more voluntary, but it's still sex trafficking in the sense of the law, eyes of the law. So that is a... That is a,
I was just going to say, anyone under the age of 18 who's in prostitution would be perceived as being a sex trafficking victim, whether they consent to do it or not. But many of the women and the girls in the United States are tricked and deceived and groomed into a situation where they eventually enter into it. Some of them will even argue that this is what they want to do. Many of them, if you go a little bit deeper, will come and say, well, I would choose to do just about anything else besides this, because, you know, it's dangerous. It's humiliating. It has all kinds of factors associated with it that that women don't like to be exposed to in their lives.
Right. And the shame that goes with it once they get out. And a lot of time, women that end up in sex trafficking, they end up doing that work later on their own, because
That's
now
correct.
There's and they acquiesce to it in the beginning. You know, they meet these, I'll just say male. I would imagine it's more males that run the reign of women that are, you know, in this, that hold them hostage. And, you know, and seeing a lot of movies on television. But I would think that, you know, when they get out of it, they still end up staying, a lot of them, in that sex work kind of life, because that's all they know. And then now they're used to it. They've been so groomed to the point that is who they have become, right? Is that so? Or,
well, in the United States, I mean, once you have a record of prostitution, it's very difficult to get a job anywhere. I mean, people don't want to hire you. They assume that you are kind of used goods in a sense, and that you are part of a criminal network and so forth, whether or not you were trafficked into it or not. In Asia, if you are kind of put into prostitution, your family doesn't want you back. You know, and we see this all the time. One of the saddest things that I used to see in Bangladesh was we would try to take a 16-year-old girl who was pulled off the street, forced into sex for a couple of weeks. We rescued her. Her family heard that that's what happened. They said, sorry, you can't stay here. You have your brothers and sisters that have to get married. You brought shame to the family. Her response is, well, I didn't do anything wrong. And they said, it doesn't matter. You know, for whatever reason, that's what happened to you. And as a result of that, and so cultural norms in much of the world related to anyone who kind of enters into prostitution is unforgiving. And, you know, they simply can't go. That's their life, because nobody wants them for anything else.
So that's unfortunate, because most of the people that are involved that work are women. Okay, so there you go.
Yes.
It's a bias, in a sense, against women. You have these criminals, mostly male, with guns on the street that get a second chance. They have a criminal record. They're a killer. They get out of jail here in Philadelphia, where I am. They're all getting out of jail. So they're getting a second chance. That's a male. So the woman here, that even if she acquiesced into this or had no choice, or her parents, sometimes in those foreign countries, the parents sell them.
Yeah,
they want to make a dollar. I've seen many movies on this. And but there's a big organizations out there now fighting with the law and getting bills passed to help these women, to bring justice to them, because so that they can have a life again, even though they have a record of prostitution. That's not the worst thing in the world. I think it's worse to have a record being a man, someone who shot someone, you know, with a gun. I think that's a worse record to have. But yet those people are getting second chances. So, you know, there is a fight. And I believe that there's some feminine, you know, activism here that's going on, and women are being, in a sense, you know, drawn back in that way, because a lot of women have started their lives that way. When I look back at some of the stories, you know, I worked for an organization in Los Angeles. I lived there 20 years for Children of the Night. Lois Lee, Dr. Lois Lee founded this organization, and I'm a dance movement artist, therapist, psychologist, and all of that. And I would go in there and help some of the girls that they would rescue, and they would only rescue so many a year off the street, and give them a life. Give them college education, et cetera, et cetera. So I don't know, because they have records of prostitution. Many of them have been arrested because their pimps, you know, control them. And of course, their pimps pay to get them out of jail. And in that sense, and I've also written a book, the DonnaGentileStory.com, and she is my first cousin with in San Diego by policemen. Ended up murdered with rocks in her mouth, got policemen fired. That's a whole nother story. You might want to include that in your book if you add some chapters. But that was police sex trafficking. People are supposed to help you and then, you know, go against you. But, and here's a woman, you know, these people, these women are they're survivors. So they don't know, and they try to be resilient. So how would you describe the book? Now the book, let's get into some of the chapters. What is, one of the most memorable stories in the book? I mean, have you interviewed women on this, or where did you get your work, information in this book? Or interviewing people?
Well, let me start with how I got into this. I was in Nepal working as a public health officer, and my job was basically to use resources to have healthier people. I had the HIV/AIDS portfolio, and we were finding girls 12, 13 years old who were HIV positive. Now, Nepal in Asia is a very conservative culture. We shouldn't have found that disease among that age group. So we went to go and interview them and heard pretty much the same story over and over again. It went something like this. Human trafficker would go into a village, flash a bunch of money around and say, I'm looking for a wife. Don't want an urban wife. I want a village wife. Find a girl 12, 13 years old, befriend her, go to the family and say, I'd like to marry your daughter. In that part of the world, it's quite common. They get married at that age. After that, they have a wedding ceremony. Everybody's there. And then he says to the family, I'm going to take your daughter to the capital, Kathmandu, but don't worry, 3 months. But that's not what's going to happen. Instead, he takes her to Mumbai, India, to the red light district where the brothels are. Puts her in a room and he says, honey, stay here. I'll be back in a few minutes. As she was coming in, she saw these people milling around, said, no, I'm scared. Stay with me. He says, it's okay. I'll be right back. He goes to the madam to get the $500 for selling her to the brothel. He has the gold from the wedding. He hands the wedding pictures over, and then he leaves to go back to do this again, maybe 40, 50 times in a year. The madam then goes into the room where the girl is and says, guess what? Your husband just sold you to me, and you're going to be with 20 guys a day every day because I say so. You can imagine her shock. No, my husband loves me. Oh, that's what happened. When many of these girls kind of internalize this, they say, I'll kill myself before I do these shameful things. Madam then brings out the photograph of the family and says, is this your mom, your dad, your brother? If you hurt yourself, we'll hurt them. So she's trapped in this situation. To make her into a prostitute, bring in a couple of professional rapists, and over a two-day period of time, they'll take this 12-year-old girl, rape her 20, 30 times until she just lays back and accepts whatever happens to her. After that, she's put on the line. She will be with 20 guys a day, every day, until after a couple of years, she gets what's called black eye, where she's so depleted physically, emotionally, and spiritually, nobody wants her. So the girls that got back to Nepal, I was interviewing them, but I didn't understand the evil of this until I actually went to those brothels. I was invited by the Indian government to do public health checks. I had a police officer with me. Went into one of the brothels. There was an 11-year-old trafficking victim. This girl saw this Caucasian guy, saw an opportunity, literally ran up, wrapped herself around me and said, "Save me, save me. They're doing terrible things to me." I looked down at this child who was hysterically crying. I turned to the police officer and said, "We need to get her out of here." I said, "We can't do that." "So what are you talking about? You're a cop." He says, "If we try to leave, we'll both be killed." To make the long story short, left, came back with a lot more police, but of course she was gone. Now, I wasn't one of those 15-year-olds that said, when I grow up, I want to be an activist. In fact, I did everything I could not to be one. But every once in a while, we have a test. That was my big test. I failed miserably. I should have gotten that girl out. I couldn't eat. I couldn't sleep. And eventually did what a lot of people do, became an activist. I can't turn it off. And so to answer your question, for the last 30 years, I've been researching. I've been working for major organizations to set up programs, to do raids and rescues, shelters, film projects, whatever it takes to basically do this. I started with the U.S. government. I did it with them for 17 years, then ran one of the largest counter-trafficking programs in the world for the United Nations all across Asia, and eventually set up an organization called the Mekong Club, which works with the private sector. So much of my experience comes from being immersed in that world for the last 30 years.
Interesting. And so you took an emotional connection to this, or just more that you were concerned about these people? I mean, what this inspiration, did it come from, you know, wanting to make things right in the world and bringing awareness, or did it come from a deeper place where, you know, you felt bad for these people, or, you know, or how did a little bit of both, maybe?
I think it started with basically just not being able to get that young girl's face out of my mind. You know, the fact that I failed her, knowing probably what happened to her afterwards, having interviewed literally thousands of victims, both the forced labor and sex trafficking victims all over the region, having come to the conclusion that this is one of the worst human rights violations you can have, because person, for the most part, loses their freedom, loses their life, loses their choices. You know, you and I, if we want to go outside and get a coffee, we do that. If we want to call a friend, if we want to go to sleep, these people have no choices. They are told by other people what to do. And there's 50 million people in the world in this situation. In fact, it was 40 million, then COVID hit, now it's up to 50 million.
So this invoked a lot. This can invoke emotion to someone who wants to write a book, or, I mean, the parents, I think, sometimes are complicit in this, or because they believe the perpetrator. Am I right or no? They believe that.
Well, a lot of people think that families sell their kids because they're so poor. And you know, it sometimes happens in a super dysfunctional family. But and you've probably saw this in your experiences in California. But even whether you're rich or poor, you still love your kids. And most people who end up allowing their kids to go off are duped and tricked into a situation where they are told that the outcome is going to be OK, only to have it not be.
And like so the that's marriage. Like the marriage one. Right?
Like the marriage, exactly. They thought this was a great thing for their daughter. Everyone's going to benefit. It's a good thing. And then all of a sudden, they never saw their daughter again. So
the awareness is there. And your book is bringing awareness. And we need to be more on this topic, because is it getting worse?
It is getting worse, because, you know, there's just more desperation. COVID had a 500 million people go who are out of poverty back into poverty. And that's simply because, you know, for a couple of years, people weren't able to work, they got indebted. And as a result of that, traffickers take advantage of that debt. And they take a family member, they'll put them in a brothel, on a fishing boat, or in a sweatshop. And so, as I say, 10 million more people are in modern slavery just because of the pandemic itself.
Right, interesting. And yeah, in Philadelphia here, we have an organization that I work with. It's called, let me see here, Women Against Human Trafficking in Philadelphia. Beverly Chandran runs this, and they're activists on this, and she's does a little talk show. I might send you to her to get, you know, maybe get an interview with her, because she has a whole organization here in Philadelphia on this. And it's big all across the country. What would
That's
you
right.
say, what country or what state is it the worst? I mean, is it coming from the How about like the islands, the Caribbean and places like that? Are they doing that over there? Young women there, taking them, bringing them to the States, or?
Much of sex trafficking in the United States is internal. It's the 14-year-old misunderstood girl who's having issues with her family. She runs away. She ends up at a bus station or a train station. The pimps are patrolling these places looking for that individual. They befriend her. They spend several weeks, showering her with love and affection, not asking her to do anything. And eventually, as a result of that, they then transition into, okay, well, me out, I need some money, you need to turn a trick. And as a result of that, they have this systematic approach that basically helps people to go into that. We see that there are Asians that are brought in for the massage parlors and for the nail salon parlors and various other ones. We see Africans and Latin Americans coming in as well. Usually if you enter a developed country and you're under the radar and you're violating some kind of laws, people can take advantage of you. And all you have to do is basically threaten to give that person over to the authorities, or basically you talk about how it's going to be a lot worse with those people than it is with us because they create this scenario about how terrible law enforcement is, and they'll beat you and rape you and torture and kill you and everything else. And so they create a sense of fear. So there's a lot of motivations that hold people in place once they're in sex trafficking in the United States.
So there's a lot of pressure and fear put upon them. Sure, I can imagine. And
Absolutely.
it just seems like people don't care. I mean, people really don't care about this subject. They think that it's the woman's fault, the girl's fault. Well, she
That's often the case,
wanted to
yeah.
do it. She wanted to be. And then they end up when once they're out and old, because when they get old, they get rid of them, correct? Once they get of a
Yeah.
certain age. It's sort of like a sport player. When you're
Yeah.
35, you're done. You're out, right?
Yeah, that's
So
right.
what is the age
That's
that
right.
they kicked them out and made all the
Well, I mean,
money?
the age that they're recruiting them is in the United States anywhere from 13, 14, 15. So you're talking about very young people. And the reason why you don't find older women in prostitution is because they just don't survive the process. The drugs, the alcohol, the abuse, the beatings, the psychological toll that it has on them. There's a certain point at which you just can't function anymore. And if you can't put the act on anymore to attract clients, because if you don't, something bad is going to happen to you. If you look depressed and sad, clients don't like that. They like the woman who appears to be happy and wanting to go along with them, and the showering of affection on somebody as if that person is so amazingly handsome that that's the reason why she's going with him. It's all an act for many of them. It's a means to an end. They either do this because they need the money, or they do this because if they don't, something bad is going to happen to them.
So they
So,
have to.
we've done films, the films that you talk about, like Taken. People often
That
talk
one,
about
I've
Taken
seen
and
that.
sex trafficking thing. And that's an action adventure. The motivation is sex trafficking, his daughter's taken away, but it's basically a father goes and kills all the bad guys and saves the girl at the end. That's not the way it works. Most
That's the one with
women in
Liam Neeson. Am I right?
Yeah,
Liam
that's right.
Neeson?
That's right. Yeah, and it's the one that everyone says, oh, that's how I know about human trafficking. But it's so simplistic in the way that it describes it. There's a whole process of how a person gets into it. There's a whole process once they're in there. There's a whole process after they leave. And you have to understand all of those things to understand what trafficking is. And going back to the awareness thing, people don't know about this. But what I've seen in the United States is if they are exposed to it and they hear about it and they kind of internalize it, a lot of people say, well, that's terrible. What can I do to help? How can I be a part of the solution? And that's really why I wrote the book, is to just help sensitize people to the fact that this is a terrible thing. It's hard to read this, but it's right there in front of you.
Who would you say the book is for? Is it for women, men? Is it for parents, to educate them?
I'd say all of those audiences. There are some books that are written for technocrats, some books that are written for just general public that wants to understand this, some for faith-based groups. What I tried to do is to be neutral in all of that. So the beginning of the book is a historical perspective. It describes my experience as how I got into it. The middle talks about, the lessons learned that I had. What did we try? What worked? What didn't work? What failed? How did we contribute to the problem? How did we reduce the problem? And in the end, it ends with a hopeful message that the world has the potential to do better. The world has done amazing things. It's increased human rights and reduced poverty. It's helped to address many issues. We have put this on as a challenge as a world collectively. We could address this, but 25,000 people enter modern slavery every day, what we call human trafficking in the United States.
What do you think about social media? Are they in support of this? Do you get a lot of support from a lot of the social media networks out there on this topic? Well, I find that sometimes they are against it in a way. They don't want it.
Yeah, I started posting on LinkedIn. I committed myself to 365, 520 word posts. And I started, it's 306 days ago. So each day I'm posting. Most of it is on human trafficking, on public health. I put some nostalgia stories in there, because if you do human trafficking every day, it's too much for people. But I've gotten tremendous support, went from, 1,500 followers to 11,000. And on a daily basis, I get people coming and saying, I work for this organization. What can I do? I have these skills. What can I do? So in a professional that if you're on Instagram or if you're on, some of the more playful type of social networking, I agree with you. They don't really want to talk about it. They're having a good day. They're happy. We don't want to see that that terrible, horrible, scary thing of human trafficking on our platforms.
Well, how about Facebook? Do they support it in the sense? I think they don't, Facebook.
Mm-mm. Well, Facebook recognizes that there's an issue and they want to address it. It's just that Facebook and other social network platforms offer an opportunity for people to be recruited and groomed, because nobody knows until you meet that person who's on the other end of that platform. You're just communicating in a way where you're giving messages and same approach that pimps use in bus stations are used on social networking, where people are groomed. People are, you have a 55-year-old guy presenting himself as a 17-year-old boy, with a 15-year-old girl, and he'll eventually get her to meet. And maybe there's a person who's 15 who's playing the role, and then they take her away to a restaurant. She gets drugged. She wakes up in a hotel room. Pictures are taken. They extort, her entering to prostitution. So social networking can be a real menace when it comes to, luring people into this type of a situation.
So basically the terminology, sex worker, prostitution. Now, these girls, of course, when a massage therapist does massage and includes a happy ending, so to speak, that's prostitution. So these girls are getting the label of being a prostitute when that is the label of the law, not of their choice. So of course, the way I view it is they're sex trafficked girls. They're not prostitutes, because prostitute is someone that's more consensual. And that is a law enforcement term that is given upon when they make that arrest to say a massage parlor. And a lot of those women in massage parlors, yes, they're brothels. And a lot of them in the Asian ones, they are sex trafficked, but a lot aren't. They're just people that want to do it. And so that falls into
in Asia. Let me just point out, in Asia, the terminology sex worker would be a person who seeks to do this because they do it by choice and they can leave and so forth. They would say a prostitute is somebody who is a sex trafficking victim. So they make that distinction. And in different parts of the world, people get very upset if you use sex worker because they say it's not work, or the word prostitute because they say it's stigmatizing. I include in the categorization, if a person is tricked and deceived into prostituting herself and she can't get out of it, then it's a sex trafficking victim for me, or if she's under the age of 18. Those are the definitions that we use. Now, there may be women who enter and say that they want to do this. As I say, usually there's a backstory. There's trauma in that person's life, abuse in that life, incest in that person's life that leads her to the situation where she feels like she can enter into this and feel like it's okay. But I'm not saying everybody who falls into this is a sex trafficking victim, but in terms of the terminology, it's every location has its own definition of what those terms mean.
Right. Because in the United States now, a general consenting, you know, person working at a massage parlor doing that, anything in a sexual way, she's considered a sex worker. They put her under, if they were to arrest her, the woman consenting, say, in a massage parlor, she would be considered sex traffic. They would give her that a charge, which would have to be demoted to prostitution, because sex trafficking is a higher charge in the law, in the eyes of the law here in the United States. So she would automatically, even though she's just some woman out there that wants to do this in her own massage parlor, say, whatever, she's going to get a sex trafficking charge. And even though she's not sex trafficking anyone or herself, that's the charge if she were to get caught. And she's really a sex worker. And then she has to demote it to prostitution, because that's a lower charge in the United States. That's the new law. I don't know if you know that.
No, I wasn't aware of that. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So you can get some, you know, Dallas Cowboy, you know, girl who was a cheerleader for years and then decides to see men and be sexy with them and run ads or whatever, and then get arrested because it's the wrong person that comes for the session, say, and she's going to get a sex trafficking charge because she is going to be considered, especially someone in the United States that doesn't have licensure in, say, massage. So if you don't have a license and you're doing massage. Now, when I lived in LA, there's a ton of massage therapists that would just do massage. They learn it, but they never had the state license. So, and then, of course, one thing led to another. They had friends come, whatever, and they did a little more sex work. They would get arrested for if you didn't have the license, whether you did the sex work or not, you get the sex trafficking charge.
But the thing about the way laws are supposed to work, and I'll talk from my perspective in Asia. In Asia, if a person chooses to be in a situation, that's one thing, and they'll be arrested and they get some kind of a charge. But if she is trafficked, she is identified as a victim and she gets support. She'd never get a charge for
She won't get the charge. No.
The people who get the charge are the ones who are pimping her out in the Johns and the Madams and so forth. So the charge is always the person who is minding that individual. They would never get so anyone under the age of 18 in the United States who is identified as doing prostitution should automatically be perceived as a victim of modern slavery or human trafficking, which means that they should get the support from the state to go to a shelter, to receive the counseling and the therapy and all of the other things that are being done. They should never be charged for sex trafficking unless they were the ones who recruited other people into that situation.
But sometimes that's a thin line, and these girls get caught up with the law. For example, my cousin in San Diego was under 18, and the Donna Gentile story and .com, but she was a girl on the street that was groomed. And then she got in with the police and they basically sex trafficked her. But she went to jail several times for the term prostitution.
But, you know, that's the problem in the United States. In the United States, the federal level says if you're under the age of 18, then the state has to help you. But lots of different locations in different cities, they don't know what the law is. They're so used to this being a vice issue. Prostitution is illegal, therefore she 14-year-old girl should be arrested, given jail time, a misdemeanor, or whatever it is. She is basically a crime that she does. She should not be. And that's, if you want to address prostitution issues and sex trafficking in the United States, all you need to do is train law enforcement across the entire country to understand that if you put a 14-year-old girl in a jail, you're breaking the law yourself. You're doing something wrong.
So it's different today than back in the 80s, 70s and 80s. We
it
have
is,
a lot
it's
more
very different.
because it's
Yes.
much more. So going back in history, how long, here's my question to you, has sex trafficking been around? When did it start? Where did it start? Like, I'm not sure that you can give me exact answers, but how long has this really been going on in the world? And when and where?
Since humankind started. You know,
they say prostitution is the oldest profession, but I mean, where they're hostaging, holding the girls hostage and the families. Was this going on in the 1950s?
This has always been there. This has always been there. You know, the only reason why sex trafficking was identified was because of HIV/AIDS. So what happened was the people who were going to the women in prostitution and talking to them would say, you know, this is what you do to protect yourself. Oh, by the way, how did you get into this situation? And then they tell the story about how they were tricked into semen, like, whoa, that's a human rights violation. You know, and so initially we thought it was just because I was working in Nepal, between Nepal and India, went to Thailand. They said, yeah, time, went all over the world. And then because people ignored women in prostitution, they were bad girls, they were criminals and so forth. They didn't give them time of day. Nobody ever stopped to listen to the fact that they were tricked and deceived and into these situations. Now that we know that, that's where, you know, the name came from. But the process of grooming people, when I was 5 years old, my mom used to tell this story about how her mom was coming from Germany to go to Los Angeles, didn't speak a word of English. My grandfather was already there, settled. So she got on a boat, went to Ellis Island, got on a train. When she got to Chicago, she thought she was in Los Angeles. And so she's going around asking people in German, am I here? Am I here? Finally, this German guy comes and says, oh, yeah, you're supposed to come with me. I'm going to take you to your husband. He was a white slaver. He was about to take my grandmother off to the brothel. As it turned out, there was a German couple that saw this, stopped it, got her back on the train. She made it to California, became the godparents of one of my sisters, and, you know, the rest is history. The point, this has been going on forever. We just haven't paid any attention to it.
Since the world has become more, well, we've become more aware of it over at least, like you said, since HIV, but I would say over the last decade, there's been more attention and awareness on the subject because there are more women's rights and there's a lot more profiling going on out there in the legal system. And so it's bringing a light to almost everything in a sense. But this one is still kind of on the back burner, I feel, because with where the profile, because it's the female. And there's a lot of organizations out there that are in, you know, in fight for this. Like, for example, you know, I didn't want to bring it up, but the Jeffrey Epstein thing, those girls were groomed.
Sure. Mm-hmm.
They were groomed. I don't know if you talk about that in your book or not. Probably not. But they were sort of in agreement. They acquiesced to it. They were young girls. They were older, like maybe teenage. Well, maybe they were 20 years old. But in that sense, it's the same thing. Now, I don't know. What did you think about that whole thing? You know.
Well, I mean, actually, the girls were 15 to 17. So they would fall into victims of human trafficking. They should have gotten help. You know, the fact that it happens at that level, you know, rich and famous people, and on the other end of the spectrum, it happens in the slums in different locations and everywhere in between. When it comes to women's issues, women tend not to get the same protection as men and not the same consideration as men. And again, when it comes to somebody who falls into the category of a fallen woman, whether she herself consented to start this or not, the shame and the stigma is still there. It's still a horrible situation. And until society changes that, you know, I think we're going to be stuck with this problem of, you know, people not caring enough to, like, I look at it from this perspective. I'll tell you the story that came up with the name for the book.
Yes, so tell me ago, that. How the story about how this title came
this,
up.
This explains a lot. So years ago, I desperately wanted to do something to address the issue. So I was going to write another book. And at that time, I was going from the girls went to one shelter. There was a girl named Gita. Every time I approached, she said, no, I don't want to give my story. But she sat and listened to all the stories that were being said. When I finished and I was leaving, Gita comes running up and says, I changed my mind. You can have my story. So she sat on one side of the table, the rest of us on the other side of the table. And over a 3-hour period, she told the worst story of rape and torture and disease and betrayal and murder. Honestly, didn't know what to say. This was the worst story I'd ever heard. And I had heard so many of them. Finally, I turned to this young girl and angry at the traffickers for the horrific things they did to you. She paused and paused. And she said, no, I'm angry at you and you and you. She said, where were you? She said that every single day she prayed for. She went to school till she was 12. She knew that everything out in the open was right out in the open. Nobody was doing anything. She said she wasn't angry at the traffickers. She said they're just bad people being bad people. She said she was angry at the good people, a society for allowing a 15-year-old girl to be commercially raped 7,000 times only to end up getting AIDS, and she was dying. She pretty much called us all out. For this to end, we as a world, as a culture, have to stop and say enough is enough. There's 6.2 million women in forced prostitution around the world today, you know, forced to have sex with these people against their will. You know, when does that become a problem? If a regular community person gets raped, everyone's up in arms. There's no difference. If there's not consent in this, what else do you call it? It's commercial rape, you know, and it's happening millions and millions and millions of times a day. Why is it so hard for us as a world to say this is unacceptable and has to be stopped, whether it's in the United States or India or Nepal or Canada or UK or anywhere else?
It's a, you know, when I read a little bit of your book, but I have to read a little more. I don't know if I have a copy of it or not, but I saw some of someone sent me an email, and it's very touching. And it's touching that a man is writing this book, because I think of men with daughters, this would be a really good read for them. A man, especially men out there, to educate the man on this, and that they have daughters. What can parents do to enlighten their daughters or save them, or, you know, protect them from getting this, something like this happening to them? I mean, we're out of control. Your child goes out, they go to school. You don't know if they're going to come home.
Yeah, you know, I mean, it's a great question. Actually, interestingly, men who have daughters tend to be a lot more sensitized to this. I have sons, but it doesn't matter. I just have a mentality that is very empathetic and compassionate. And when I see somebody who's being disenfranchised or their rights are being abused and so forth, it bothers me. It's part of, you know, like who I am. And the reason why I say that is that we don't pick our causes. Our causes pick us. So I didn't wake up one day and say, out of these 10 things, this is what I'm going to do. I think I'll pick this one over that one. There's something in my DNA that draws me to this. And a lot of the people who are in this field of ours are in the same situation. They're drawn to it because of something about that. But, you know, parents have to be concerned about this because, again, because of social networking, people can, the sexploitation, which is another phenomena, which basically, you know, grooms the person into eventually showing some skin, and then they extort money and do all kinds of other things that results in the person being so embarrassed and so afraid that the world's going to find out and see a picture of them that they end up getting deeper and deeper into this. They have to be taught, you know, if somebody is on the other end of the line and it sounds too good to be true, it probably is. And you shouldn't trust anyone. You shouldn't share any information about yourself. You should really just focus on the people in the real world that you know. Because you never know who that person is going to be. And if parents don't have the ability to do that, then the school should be doing that, or the faith-based group should. Somebody needs to be doing it, because that's a danger that we all face. And we all, when we were growing up, were told, don't get into a stranger's car. Don't take candy from a stranger. It's an extension of that same message.
Right. And it's amazing how a lot of women are sort of naive in the sense of believing what the perpetrator is there for, or the, you know, the, when they're young and they're coming up, they want to, you know, sort of show they're coming into their sexuality more, and they want to show their body, the cosmopolitan woman, you know, and then to find that they're being trapped in a way, you know, from wanting to just be the person that they are, the part of the growth that's important in any human being.
Well, you know, I mean, there was a domestic helper who worked in one of my friend's house who was groomed by somebody in the UK. And so because of the work that we do, we were asked to do a trace on the individual in the UK, and found out that he had three websites, and he was much older than he said. And He lied about all kinds of things, had association with, porn establishments and so forth. And so despite the fact that we went to her and said, this is the reality of this person, and she still left Hong Kong to go to the UK because hope springs eternal. She wanted it so badly to be real. The model or the wannabe model who is told that if you come to New York, you can get this great career, you can be an actress, right, all these other things. Those dreams are just so strong that you put caution off to the side because you almost will it to be real. You almost will it to be genuine when in fact it isn't. And when you're young, you haven't had enough of those burns to know that you're about to put yourself in a situation where something terribly bad is going to happen, because all the signs are there from somebody like me who's seen it a thousand times. But you, even if I'm telling you this, you don't see it. What can I do?
Right.
In that kind of situation? It's terrible.
Well, as a young girl growing up here in Philly and Atlantic City, there were moments like that men would offer me. And I was young in my teens and going to be, when the casinos first started to open in Atlantic City, it was like a young girl's thing, dream to be there and be in the center of it all. And I will have to say that there were times, but there's something in you that maybe you get from your parents, that some kind of message that comes like, this isn't right. And I really think that the message from the parents, look, we're all going to be, I was very naive at one point with, and I'm young and, and they wanted me and yeah, sure. I fell into little traps, but nothing like sex trafficking. I think I was saved from that in a sense, because I mean, I wasn't stupid. I'm not saying that these people are stupid, but I just think that there's something that there's the message that the parents, or that they hear, not like don't get in a car with a stranger or don't hitchhike or don't sleep with men, or, you're going to, you're growing, you're going to be sleeping. You're a young girl. You want to have your sexual organs satisfied and pleasured. You're growing family one day and babies, you have to learn. But I think that there's this thing with the parents that really need to kind of, there's some kind of a loss within the girl that kind of goes into that. In a sense, that believes. In a sense, Go ahead.
The thing is, your parents tend to not be very good at talking about sexuality with their kids. And it's partly because they don't want to have that talk when the kids are young, when in fact they need to have it at an age when they're beginning to experiment and so forth, but they don't. So unless parents are able to be trained and taught what to say and how to say it, then they're not going to do it. So part of the reason for educating parents is for them to understand that this is a big, bad world out there that has these type of people out there. And they have to understand that those people are going to prey on your kids, And so right. As a parent, if you want to be protective of your kids the way you are with, how they spend their money and the decisions and everything else they make, then this is part of what you have to have as their education. But I don't see much of that actually happening in the United States to help parents themselves understand the vulnerability of this. Because as I say, when I was doing this study tour with my wife across Canada and United States, 53 days, I would halfway through the talk ask people, how many of you knew 10% of what I was talking about before I said it today? Room of 600 people, sometimes professional bankers or educators or whatever, and I would never get more than 5 or 6 hands, and the reason for that is that the information is just not out there. So awareness, that's why I do the LinkedIn posts, that's why I write these books, that's why I do podcasts, is because as a human being who's seen this firsthand and understands the absolute evil and sheer ugliness of what we're talking about, recognizing that it happens to a lot of people that are very similar to you and I, I just feel this need to help get to a point where enough people know about it, where eventually there's this awakening where we say, as a world, this enough is enough. Like what happened with global warming, where there are enough people said it's time.
Yeah. And it's really, I think the awareness has to be with the parents. So, because the young girls are always going to that those invites with men and the Cosmopolitan, and we're going to make you a movie star, and they're going to go for it because everybody has a dream. And but there's has to be that part of them inside, that resilient or that strength that says, hey, this doesn't feel right. And it's perception, it's intuition. And in the schools and the parents need to have more of this, because we're not going to be with our daughters 24 hours a day. They're going to go into the world. They're going to have boyfriends. They're going to go on trips and travel. It's a big world there. It's no big deal for an 18-year-old to get on a plane and travel the world with a guy today. Yeah. It really isn't. Yeah. And who knows if she'll come back, or she'll get sex trafficked. But there has to be this strength that we have to give to our children, where something comes into the brain that says, this doesn't feel right. And that is where the education needs to be. There has to be more psychological input in the parents and the children. And because I see that a lot of people don't pay attention to this, but yet they're teaching them other things, don't marry the wrong man, or don't do this, or don't, so if what do you say to people who find it hard to read a book like this? Would they be, are people finding it hard to read a book like this, or are they, emotion for them, or shame, or?
This particular book, and it pulls back and a little bit more, because I understand the pacing of this. And I know this because I wrote a novel years ago, based on sex trafficking in Asia. And when I wrote the book, the victims and survivors that I spoke to basically said, you have to tell our story. You can't sugarcoat it. You got the good, the bad, and the ugly had to be there. So I maintain that. And so by page 60, when the initial kind of initiation rape scene was taking place, they said, no, this is too much. I can't read this. I'm having a really good day today. And so here they are in their living room. They have the AC on. They have a cup of coffee. They have a nice light. They have the book. They can't even read words on a page. It would be like to be that person. And I think we have to feel this. I think we have to inoculate ourselves with the fact that what we're talking about here is really ugly. And you can't turn away from the ugliness. You have to accept the fact that it exists. Until you do that, you're not going to get to the point where you're outraged, where you say something needs to be done to address this. This is terrible. This is awful. This is bad. And
people turn a blind eye to it in denial. There's a lot of denial about this subject. But reading a book like this, of course, could make someone feel painful, hurt, and feel bad for these people. But reading it could also, they can empathize better with your book.
They can empathize,
and they may want to step into the light and help, step out in the world and help people. Here's a question. Do you see a lot of boys being sex trafficked, or what percent of that?
It's probably less than 5%.
Okay.
But it happens. Like in different locations, you'll see, especially young boys, infant type boys, five and under often are used. In the Philippines, you'll see online sexual exploitation where, kids will be asked to do certain things, and, people from the West are watching this and so forth. So it happens. It's not as common as, and, there's less sympathy for them as well. If a 14-year-old boy is forced into prostitution for gay sex, there's little sympathy for that person. He's doing it because he wants to. He's gay, and so he's doing it.
Interesting. This has been a really good conversation we're having. What else do you want to tell me? We maybe have about 5 more minutes left or so. What else do you want to tell me about the book? What can people do out there to help? What can the average person do to be a part of this, to help out?
Well, I think the first thing is to read the book so that you understand what it is we're talking about, so that you have the definitions and the understandings and the cases and the examples and, what's worked and what hasn't worked. Second thing is to be a part of raising awareness. Give the book to somebody else or go online. And if you see an article on this, share it with your network. Talk about this with your family and your friends and your colleagues. You can be a responsible consumer. A lot of what we're talking about related to human trafficking is labor trafficking, where people work in sweatshops and so forth. So before you go and buy online to see if the company that you're buying from has a policy. If they do, congratulate them. If they don't, say, listen, I like your products, I'd feel better. You can volunteer. My organization that works with the private sector has about 70 volunteers, professional people who want to give back. They heard about the stories. They heard about the issues. They want to use their communication skills, their legal skills, their public speaking skills, their administration skills. And we help to link them up with NGOs and so forth so they're able to do that. Or make donations. There are a lot of organizations post-COVID that are suffering. The resources aren't there. And for them to do what it is that they need to do, they need this support. So all those things, they may seem small, but if a million people did that, that's a million kind gestures that would add up to something quite big. So part of awareness raising is to get enough people to just accept some responsibility and want to do something, even if it's something.
Is fundraising available for this to help the organizations
to
fight
the book
it?
Is sold for the purpose of raising money for fundraising to address modern slavery and human trafficking.
So that's where the proceeds of the book go. Right. I did read that.
Right.
Yes. So this has been a really wonderful topic. And you know, I like talking about this, and I don't feel the shame. I just feel that I want to stop it. I want to end it. And after reading the book and this, I feel that it's a strength that has to come into people, not a shame, not a denial. So we need to get stronger and we need to talk about it more. But I feel like it's just not a subject that people talk about. You know, they kind of look the other way. Are you doing anything else with this? Are you going out doing a lot of podcasts and things with the story here?
I do about 300 presentations a year. You know, schools, high schools, junior high schools, universities, corporations, banks, faith-based groups, government offices. So anyone who wants to basically understand this, we'll do a presentation for them. And that. To get the information that they need to understand how this relates to their own life. Whether it's, you know, in the banking world, you have to be concerned about this because $150 billion is generated from modern slavery. If that money gets to a bank, they get fined and penalized. One bank was fined $1.3 billion as a result of this. You know, the manufacturing world has to care about this. The hospitality world has to care about this. And as human beings, we should all care about this because what we're talking about is so terrible and ugly that it shouldn't exist. And so what we are trying to do with this awareness is just expose people to this and figure out what their entry point is being part of the solution.
Interesting. Wonderful. Well said. All right. So I think that we're going to wrap it up, Matt.
Okay.
And then you'll tell me where they can find you. You've been listening to Discover Joyous Love, and this is my episode number 46, folks. Anyway, I'm Anita DeFrancesco, your host, and my guest today has been Matt Friedman, the author of Where Were You? A Profile of Modern Slavery. His book, it is wonderful, it can be found. Tell us where they can find you.
I'm in Hong Kong. I'm online. You can find me at the Mekong Club. When you post this, you can put my I'll give you some information.
Where is the book? Where can they get the book?
Oh, it's on Amazon. It's a Penguin Random House book, so it's just about everywhere.
Okay, and okay? So the book is available, and where else they can just find you at Mekong MekongClub.com.
That's correct. Yes.
Okay. Well. All right. I want to thank you, Matt, for being a wonderful guest today. And I'm going to say goodbye for now.
Okay, very good. Thank you for the opportunity to talk today.